This is Melissa, and it is the 30th of August, 2026. Once I synced up the calendar and got with Alan in 2020, I decided to stay there for a while because his talks in 2020 were very profound, and I know they were helpful for many of you. Many of you found him during that time, and it can be challenging sometimes to pick out an hour or an hour and a half of it or 50 minutes and just say this is the, you know, section to look at, because really the whole 4 or 5 hours of each of these talks is well worth listening to again. But you'll hear today the first 50 minutes of the talk that he gave on the 30th of August, 2020, and the total runtime is just about 4 hours and a quarter, and I will link to the original as well as the transcript of it. You can listen to it in full if you like. The poem, the title and poem that go with it, Elites Working Complicity Toward Efficiency. Hear the cries of anarchy, arson, sedition. Kissinger's New World Order comes into view. It's said Bolshevik hell is just repetition, so masses can be ruled by technocratic few. So it came up in the book club discussion yesterday. Are we headed to world government? Are we already under it? And I think that Alan demonstrates, particularly in the books, that we are already under it. In his talks, he gives us the organizations, the non-governmental organizations, the think tanks that move us, I guess you could say, closer to the revealing of the system that we're under. And I think that may be an important part of where we are, is that there's so much chaos, there's so much change at such a rapid pace, it becomes increasingly difficult. Maybe that's one reason. It becomes increasingly difficult to pretend that it's business as usual. Or maybe it's revelation of the method. I'm not quite sure. But what we are seeing now is, if you're looking, is that what crazy thing that your government is doing that makes absolutely no sense to you, if you look elsewhere to see what another government is doing, you are probably going to find some similarities. So it's an excellent first 50 minutes, and I just wanted to read a few things out of Alan's Cutting Through books. And I am in the second edition, and I'm reading from, I think everything that I'm choosing to share with you tonight comes from the third volume, Esoteric Unveiled and the Meaning of Revelations in the High Masonic Tradition. I want to make just a couple of general announcements regarding book club and a few other things. I will post some announcements on Telegram so that people who have been waiting to get involved with reading and covering Alan's books can be aware of this. But we had a session yesterday and we got through degrees 25, 26, and 27. And we had already decided that we were going to separate out 28 because it's incredibly long. It's more than 200 pages just for that degree. But I realized as we were going that we weren't going to get past 28. We weren't going to be able to skip over it and cover 29 through 32 in any depth whatsoever. So we have decided to take 4 weeks of study, and that will give all of those of you who are reading along, not everybody shows up for the Zoom call, but you're reading along. On the 26th of September, we will be covering degrees 28, 29, 30, 31, and 32. And those last degrees are much shorter. So the bulk of the reading is degree 28, but that gives us about a month to do that. So we won't be meeting for a month. We'll resume with a Zoom call on the 26th. And as always, these recordings, the audio, the illustrated audio portion of it, will be posted on Substack, and supplementary things that we put in there. And one of the members of book club, Suzanne, took a very interesting trip to Jung's house, where his office and his library were, and she had a lot of interesting things that she shared. And it kind of fits in because, you know, the question is, was Jung a Freemason? And his grandfather was. And I think I just kind of cut to the chase on that. Clearly, this was a person who had been initiated in one way or another into the mystery religion. And what is the mystery religion? Well, that's what we're covering in book club, in Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma. And I think at the heart of Freemasonry, and this is what we are discovering as we read it, is in large part its training of the managerial class. Who are the managerial class? They are the scientists. They are the politicians. They are the educators. So just because you can't point to a politician and say, oh, yes, I see he belongs to Lodge such and such, I don't think we should get caught up on the brotherhood or the name of a lodge. This is a system. It's an ancient interlocking system. And I do think that foundations, their power and influence, all of this non-governmental organizations that so control academia, the whatever it is that your children learn in school from the time they enter school until they get into university and beyond, this is an important part of how their minds are molded. And I've shared this before. This is just an aside here. But, you know, another thing that pops up that Blue keeps pointing out, reminding us, remember, we're looking at the androgynous agenda. You can't help but see that when you study Pike's book, that yes, that is where they're headed. It took Alan, I think it took Alan Watt, to digest all of this in Freemasonry and find many, many, many examples that show, yes, this is the way we're going. So the first volume of the Cutting Through book, for for new people that don't have the book, that was entitled The Androgynous Hermaphroditic Agenda. But what I'm concentrating on tonight is volume 3. So here are just a few little sections that I wanted to read to you. This is on page 194 of the second edition. Empires obliterate the distinctions which are peculiar and unique to individuals and impose systems which can be as alien to the individual on which it is imposed as the mood of the scientist may be to the artist or poet. A world state is achieved by the cohesion of things below, with the intellect as the manipulating force. The individual is remade into the image of a man-made, scientifically efficient organism. Individual energies are surrendered to energies more powerful than themselves. And I'll just interject here that that's what you see when you study Freemasonry. You see how a system, a brotherhood, is taking the energy of individual Freemasons and using them for the great work. The more dominant the state, the more the will of the individual is made incapable of effort, or even the desire for effort. We lose that diamond hardness which can only be maintained by continuous effort, never relaxed for a single instant. I want to read just a tiny little section of Carl Jung's The Undiscovered Self, which we just covered in book club a couple of months ago. And I will point out, too, that regardless of Jung's background, his Freemasonic connections, his Gnosticism, his mystery religions, there's a lot of truth in his writing, and there's a lot of truth in his book, The Undiscovered Self, which I think is one reason why Alan Watt chose to read from that several times for us. This is on a PDF version of the book on page 43. Jung writes, "Resistance to the organized mass can be effected only by the man who is as well organized in his individuality as the mass itself." I fully realize that this proposition must sound well nigh unintelligible to the man of today. The helpful medieval view that man is a microcosm, a reflection of the great cosmos in miniature, has long since dropped away from him, although the very existence of his world-embracing and world-conditioning psyche might have taught him better. Okay. Resistance to the organized mass can be effected only by the man who is as well organized in his individuality as the mass itself. I am going to just repeat what Alan Watt wrote on page 194, cutting through. Individual energies are surrendered to energies more powerful than themselves. The more dominant the state, the more the will of the individual is made incapable of effort, or even the desire for effort. We lose that diamond hardness which can only be maintained by continuous effort, never relaxed for a single instant. You're not, I think it is impossible. This is something that comes up a lot too with me. It is advisable. Is it advisable to grow your own food? Yes. Is it advisable to have a source of water that you can depend on? Hopefully, yes. Basic preparedness is a good thing. But to think that you can organize yourself against the kind of privations that we've already lived through. Just think back to 2020 and what is coming. It's not realistic. So it's something in your mind, in your psyche, that you have to prepare yourself for. I want to read another paragraph from Alan's third volume here, 196 into 197. It may be obvious to some that the government they think they elect appears to have an agenda differing from the wishes of the people, and never mentioned by authorized media. Behind politicians are appointed advisors. Who trains and selects them? Behind the soap of parliamentary congressional debates are armies of bureaucrats, the departmental heads often reporting directly to counterparts within the United Nations. These directors, along with their staff of hereditary bureaucrats, do not wait around for politicians to give them orders. On the contrary, they are busy bees working fervently for global government. Because they are seldom mentioned in the press, the general public tend to dismiss them as impotent shadows. Yet the bureaucracies are into every area of life. They draft laws regarding procedures regarding all civic areas of life. Governments come and go, but bureaucracies are forever. I want to say before I forget that I do have the second edition available for you. After we finish Pike's Morals and Dogma, on the 26th of September, we're going to have a break for just a little over a month. And so you have plenty of time to get the second edition if you don't have it, so that you can read along with us or join in the conversation. I'm working on some other projects, and I'll say right here, too, that I'm grateful for Graham and Gabriella, G&G, for illustrating Alan's portion of this redux for us. It really helps me to have help because I can take some time to do other things that I need to do and want to do. So I think our first session on Zoom to talk about the cutting through. We'll start with volume one. Will be on the 31st of October. So you've got a couple of months to fetch the second edition that we're reading from. But I want to say that I have that. I still have some flash drives. There are discs that you can purchase. There's Waiting for the Miracle. Waiting for the Miracle is available in English, German, Spanish, and Portuguese. And another huge thank you to Graham and Gabriella, who translated Waiting for the Miracle into German. So, most appreciative of their hard work. They did a beautiful job on it. And so what I'm saying is go to the website, www.cuttingthroughthematrix.com, and find out how you can support Cutting Through the Matrix. You can support what I'm doing if you like what I'm doing. And there's many ways. You can become a paid subscriber to Substack. You can buy books and discs, etc. You can have a monthly subscription. You can send me a letter to Post Office Box 815 Keene, K-E-E-N-E, Texas 76059. Doesn't have to have a donation included. That would be nice, but I do love hearing from you. So there are a couple of little news stories that I want to just mention really quickly here. And there's a thread that ties in with what Alan Watt is going to be talking about in this section. A couple of articles related to food shortages and food crises come to me from Neil Foster. Thank you very much. And this is from The Guardian. 25th of August, 2026. UK to warn citizens to stock up on food amid threat from climate crisis and hostile states. Government resilience campaign aims to ensure people can cope in a national disaster in order to free resources for most vulnerable. Now, there's a picture of a burned out house surrounded by green trees, but it's a wildfire that broke out across the West Midlands. So it's one of those wildfires that burn structures, but not trees. This is almost like chemtrails, right? The new clouds that became the new normal. People won't even remember what a forest fire looked like, just like you won't remember what real clouds look like and the real sky looked like, because forest fires would just burn houses and cars, right? And they leave all the trees standing. UK citizens will be told to stock up tinned food and take steps to ensure they are prepared for national emergencies as part of a new government campaign to improve the nation's resilience. The new campaign from the Cabinet Office will set out ways people can prepare for extreme weather events, because they're going to keep bringing them to us, and potential attacks from hostile states, including stocking up on bottled water. The aim will be to ensure most households have basic supplies and knowledge about how to cope in a crisis in order to free up immediate government resources for the most vulnerable. Planning for a number of disasters. Planning for a number. I think they're planning a number of disasters. From cyber attacks to extreme heat and flooding has increased over the past few months after a number of incidents both in the UK and across the world. The plans, first reported by the Financial Times, also include an internal reassessment of government preparations for a military attack by a hostile state affecting Britain. Now, I will post that for you and a couple of other things. But like I said, it's just good common sense to have some preparation in place. What this article is, and the next ones that I'm reading, the articles themselves are the warfare, right? You're being reminded that you are in a state of war. You're in a state of war. What country are we at war with now? Well, we're at war with the country of climate change. This is from Dublin Live, 28 August 2026. Irish households urged to stockpile food and water in preparation for, quote, emergencies. The government has launched its national Be Emergency Ready campaign, encouraging households across Ireland to take simple steps to prepare for emergencies and periods of disruption. And they supply a photo there with some cans of food, a first aid kit, and a woman putting a roll of toilet paper up in the cabinet. California farmer ordered to destroy orchard after giving away free nectarines, part of a wider squeeze on small farmers. I think that Neil Foster and I covered this a couple of months ago with Sandy Adams, and that was an episode of Real History from June 11, 2026. I can link to that as well, so if you missed it, you can hear it. But yes, the attack on U.S. farmers, particularly around these peach and other fruit trees in California, is just outrageous. So in the case that we covered a couple of months ago, it was Del Monte closing canneries and then just canceling contracts. In June, Cesar Mora became briefly famous for the right reasons. The third-generation farmer in Reedley, California, locked out of the market by a contract dispute with a leading California produce marketer, decided to give away his entire crop rather than watch it rot. More than 182,000 pounds of nectarines were picked by over 6,000 community members in a single week, the Independent reports. 2 months later, a jury found him guilty of breaching his contract, and his trees are being destroyed. On August 13, a Fresno County Superior Court ruled that Mora had violated a marketing agreement with Guiamara Brothers Fruit Company. Guiamara was awarded no damages, but a judge had already ruled before the trial that Mora's trees, the source of the Mona Lisa white nectarines at the center of the dispute, must be demolished. "This isn't going to destroy me, but I'll tell you this, I'm not going to farm anymore," Mora told the Fresno Bee. "I can't farm in an industry where a company can treat their growers this way and literally use the legal system to punish them." Mora signed a sublicensing agreement with Guiamara in 2017 to grow and sell the Mona Lisa white nectarine, a proprietary variety. Under a follow-up marketing agreement signed in 2019, he was required to sell exclusively through Guiamara. But Mora alleged that around half the nectarines he delivered to Guiamara in 2020 were thrown away, reducing his profits. In 2023, Mora ended the relationship and sold to another packer. Guiamara sued him for breach of contract. Mora countersued, arguing he had been misled about the company's actual licensing rights and had engaged in unfair practices. A judge ruled that the sublicensing agreement was valid, regardless of underlying patent status. So it's interesting because he wasn't selling to a competitor. He just gave them away. I have mentioned before that it might be a good idea for you to watch a movie called Land of the Blind. It's an uneven movie from about 20 years ago. And by uneven, I mean, you know, it could have had a better pass at the writing and the editing, etc. So some sections drag on too long, but it is well worth watching. Because in so many ways, you see vivid examples of where we are right now. It's a political satire starring Ralph Fiennes, Donald Sutherland, Tom Hollander, and Lara Flynn Boyle. Dark political satire. It's a tyranny, and we come into an unnamed country ruled by a petulant tyrant. Who does that make us think of? And his beautiful yet cruel wife, Josephine. Well, I say watch it and then look at what is going on in the U.S. with the President of the United States. FDA approves new COVID-19 shots. So you can have all the political theater that you want. Those shots are coming. A former associate of Dr. Anthony Fauci pled guilty to charges he was involved in. This isn't brand news. This is about 10 days old, but I'm mentioning it here. David Morins, a former senior advisor at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, has been charged with conspiracy against the United States, destruction, alteration, or falsification of records in federal investigations, concealment, removal, or mutilation of records. In one communication, Morins wrote, "I can either send stuff to Tony on his private Gmail or hand it to him at work or at his house. He's too smart to let colleagues send him stuff that could cause trouble." So what we have is a president who is building a ballroom. A ballroom in the scheme of things is not the most expensive thing on the face of the earth. They estimate it'll cost taxpayers about $300 million, although the president said repeatedly it wasn't going to cost taxpayers anything. It's a 90,000 square foot addition, and it is twice the size of the main part of the White House. Architecturally, it's an abomination. Just like the gold that he's put in the Oval Office. Watch Land of the Blind to see. This is a president whose net worth has increased by like $3 or $4 billion since his second term here in 2025. The primary driver of that increase of his wealth is the cryptocurrency ventures. And is this good? It's corrupt. Is it legal? I don't know, but it's corrupt. His son, his young son, Barron. What a name, I mean, why not name your child Viscount? His young son has become very nearly a billionaire due to, just how they're making money off of him being president. It's disgusting. So every week he says, it's bad. Things are really bad. I mean, this has been proved out. He's manipulating the stock market. And then it's good. And then it's bad. And then, this is manipulation. Manipulation of the stock market or insider trading, whatever you want to call it, it's corruption. It's just disgusting. And he has waged war against the Iranians in a way that we haven't seen in modern warfare. Well, we are seeing it now in the last some decades, where we don't care about collateral damage. We don't care about women and children. We simply are going to bomb people into oblivion. I think those were his words. So Trump's Navy punishes the 19-year-old sailor who threw himself overboard in, quote, suicide attempt after months abandoned at sea. So he was a 19-year-old service member, a married father of two children, faces non-judicial punishment for violating the military code, according to his wife. Earlier this month, he hurled himself overboard in an apparent attempt to drown during a mental health crisis as living conditions aboard the ship deteriorated. Sailors aboard the Lincoln are said to have endured moldy showers, broken toilets, laundry outages, food shortages, and long stretches without water. Okay, so the national debt. The United States now has a debt that's just, it's more than you can wrap your head around. The interest on it, the U.S. is paying $1.5 trillion per year in net interest on the national debt. So that figure surpassed total defense spending for the first time in modern history. So $1.5 trillion a year is spent just to pay the interest on the national debt. The Congressional Budget Office projected that those will double to about $2.14 trillion by 2036. Do you sense that possibly some Weimar-type hyperinflation is coming? Meanwhile, I've mentioned before Scott Bessent, the man who had the Pink Palace house. Inept, incompetent, craven, Scott Bessent struggles to clean up the president's mess. This is, don't buy the idea that it's the president's mess. We're living through something that was designed to be this way. There's little optimism about Treasury Secretary's ability to handle Trump's tariffs, Iran's sanctions, and colossal U.S. debt. History remembers General Dwight Eisenhower, the supreme commander of the Allied forces in Europe during the Second World War, for his role in the D-Day invasion of Normandy. Whether Scott Bessent will achieve similar posterity as the face of the economic D-Day in Iran remains to be seen. The U.S. Treasury Secretary, already trying to manage a $40 trillion national debt, this week took charge of Donald Trump's effort to reverse engineer his war of choice. And by reverse engineer, they mean, wouldn't it have made much more sense to start off? I mean, if it's a real world with economic sanctions and diplomacy, et cetera, but no, he just bombs the heck out of them for 6 months. So Steve Schmidt, a former political strategist for President George W. Bush in the John McCain presidential campaign, said he is bar none the worst Treasury Secretary in the history of the United States. Because the first Treasury Secretary was a true genius, the distance between Alexander Hamilton and Bessent in evolutionary scale is the difference between a flea and a human being. He is inept. He is incompetent. He is dishonest. He is smug. He is craven. And goes on to tell you about Scott Bessent and his involvement in the MAGA movement. First openly gay Treasury Secretary, etc., etc. But what I see in the news stories lately is the revealing of the ugly, rabid teeth of the crazed beast that behind the mask. The mask has come off, and so we're seeing what is. On page 204 of the third volume of Cutting Through, Alan Watt wrote, "The utopia planned for most of man would be a hell. The closest character in fiction we have for it would be the emotionless, ultra-rational Mr. Spock of Star Trek fame. Emotion is to be all but eradicated from the bulk of humanity. All mystical organizations have this in their agenda. The sciences have a very large role to play in all of this." What I see, too, in the unrolling, the unfolding of the AI part of this, and the distraction of people by their gadgets and by the most importantly, by the bombardment of news and bad news, is that people retreat, they lose affect, you know, flat affect is a sign of unwellness, and people who spend all their time doom scrolling and looking at devices and not into the eyes of their fellow man, they lose affect, they lose proper emotional reaction. On 205, Alan continues, "How do you plan to take over the world? You must first possess knowledge of human nature. This may take eons of study, watching, listening, perhaps cautiously experimenting with a few captured primitives. Watch how they barter for their needs. Why, when one gets sick or old, the tribe sustains him. So how do you make people selfish? Look at how they share everything, even leaving some of their food on that stone for their gods. Now, if I could impress them with a few scientific tricks, they would be in awe of me." So don't be awed by the talking heads of science, by the people who come out and say, we've found a better way. Let me tell you how it is. Hold on to, you know, make yourself diamond hard. Hold on, organize your individuality against the mess and recognize that you are in a constant wartime scenario. That's what, you know, we are in World War III, if you want to look at it that way. It's constant. Bad news everywhere you turn. I'll mention too, Ellen said something about a video, and I'll post that for you here. It's called Wartime Farm, and this was about a little over a dozen years ago from the BBC. It's kind of one of these enacted history presentations where they show us what it would be like to have a farm in World War II Britain. And it's interesting. And this is the part of the phase we're in right now. We've got plenty of water for data centers, but there's not enough water for you. We've got plenty of money to wage war on Iran on behalf of another country, and we don't really care if that means that there are shortages of fertilizer and therefore down the food chain problems. We don't care that we've got the highest debt in the history of humanity. We're going to have a ballroom with an underground bunker, the size of which the world has never seen. So it isn't good news. I don't see good news except in the way that I choose to share with you on Real History or personal encounters on, you know, the street with, you know, just people that I meet in real life. I see still humanity. And that's something to be thankful for. So have a safe week, have a good week, take care, and thank you very much for your support.
Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 30th of August 2020. And as always, I hope you're hanging in there and getting through these insane times, because we're living through the biggest exercise, really, in mind control and warfare. It's all warfare. It's mental warfare in the whole population of the planet. And psyops, etc., and revolutions, all sponsored often and traced back to the same few people. It's quite astonishing, isn't it, that regardless of the COVID idea and the Bill Gates Foundation, the Melinda Gates Foundation, and Fauci and all these characters, and the head of the WHO, you can tie them all together, can't you? And you see all the funding from the same old big corporations going to BLM, which again is Marxist, as we know. A beautiful cover, though. Remember, communism always hides behind covers. It uses excuses. It always did. There were dozens and dozens of them in the 1960s that were Christian. And the Christian groups and churches had no idea they were getting used. But they were great covers, because they would promote policies which the Marxists wanted to be put into, to weaken America, actually. And that's what you always find. Behind the covers, there's a weakening of the state. And yeah, you can always complain about the state as much as you want. The state of affairs isn't that great, is it? But the reality, too, is that there are other players that simply want to end up in the ruling seats and displace the present rulers of it all. That's really what it is. Or really, to maximize their power, their existing power, and take over the remaining seats in politics and governance and so on. And you have to understand that you're living through amazing times, that nothing's happening by chance. You've got the Pentagon, obviously, in on the same act, with different generals standing by. They're all in the payroll of the military-industrial complex, which will still be working for a long time. under the auspices of the United Nations and NATO organization, as they again go through this game of divvying up the world into competing factions of apparent conflict. You know, that's how the Cold War was, really. There were more billionaires created during the Cold War than ever before, maybe even afterwards, because all governments on all sides took tax money and put billions and billions, without question, into defending the people by creating more and more missiles, etc., and jets and military equipment. Way overpriced, anyway, it doesn't matter what they made, it was always way overpriced. But no questions were asked. Like the COVID idea, it's to keep you safe. So it's, you know, it's a wartime scenario, you see. And of course, COVID has all the attributes of a wartime scenario. Of course it does. More than you think, actually. Because there are signs and symptoms to techniques of controlling the public through fear and wartime for compliance reasons. And we've had all the exercises exposed from Event 201 and long before that too, with the Rockefeller lockstep idea as well. And again, many other organizations that some of them I'll mention tonight, that the Gavi and Bill Gates group still control as well. There are so many organizations, you see, all telling you the same stories. So important to control all the media and the flow of information. You think you've got lots of competing organizations giving... they're giving the same opinions, all the media, the official media, because they're all owned by a small coterie of people. Going way back, I mentioned that years ago in talks, when Rockefeller and others, the Rockefeller especially, got a group of his hijackers, you know, to get, because they hijacked other companies all the time to basically take them over and stop competition. Old man Rockefeller said that competition is a sin. And he meant it. There's an organization running the world that truly believes they have the right to own everything in it, the technocratic type, and to rule everybody under it, basically. That hasn't changed. It's more than ever enforced today. You can actually see some of the front people coming forward, maybe lower edges of them, but it's still the same organization. And the idea was to take over the world's resources, everything that you need to exist as an individual human being, and then collectively is owned by people you don't even know, generally. They make all the policies, how much food you're going to be able to buy or even get, or even if you can get it, or even if you can buy it. And it's all coming to pass right now, because this is to be your winter of discontent is coming up. Because it'll either make or break this big agenda for the World Economic Forum, for its global reset, you know, of the economy, of your way of living, on the value, actual value, and the basically the... almost like an examination paper with tick marks. You'll all get checked off on a checklist of things that they'll give you extra help if you need it, if you're ill or whatever it happens to be, according to your status or importance or necessity to their society. That's how it's going to get put out, actually. It's already in force. And that's why they're killing a lot of elderly people in the hospitals. It was in force before COVID came along, when they introduced euthanasia. Everything's economics, you see. And the value to their system, even though you paid for it, it doesn't make any difference. They're thieves that run the world, and they have all the signs and symptoms of gangs, and that's a fact. There are other people who have come out with this too, that you have all the signs and symptoms of organized crime, big, big organized crime at the very top. And the relationship, as I've mentioned before, between Bill Gates, Melinda Gates Foundation, and don't forget to Fauci and his wife. And his wife too is a bioethicist working with the government to again evaluate everybody's status in society and your value to the system. And that's what bioethics is all about, folks. That's what it's about. So you're living through the big scientific takeover of society for the planet. They've always been after this global society, and going way back into the 1800s, folk have no idea that the British Empire, this oddball thing, the British Empire, was run by a secretive group in the city of London, Lord Alfred Milner. He published books himself about it. And he, and again, some of the people who took over much later, like Carl Quigley, who was a historian for them, praised them to the highest heavens for taking over the world and trying to get a world governmental system in place. Again, with this, he didn't mention technocratic system, but that's what it was. Quigley knew it was, because he believed that the right, again, to go after the world's resources even then, and he was all for their agenda. And Britain was used, really. The people who get used, generations can pass, they haven't got a clue they're being used. You understand that? They just think, well, we're off to another war with so-and-so today, and it might last for a few years. And after it's over, you don't realize, no, maybe 24 people have corporations in London that end up ransacking that country by taking resources out of it, and your troops are guarding it all for them. Even the troops don't really know what they're there for, except they're bringing civilization, they think, to these people. It's quite amazing to watch it happen, because it's still happening today. Huh? Often the countries that were dominated are coming back to the parent countries, like Britain, and dictating to them now, because often in some ways they become wealthier themselves, the people that were left behind, and now they're dictating their policies too for a global system again, because everyone from every nation at the top is part of this big structure. They know what's going on. Of course they know what's going on. And Quigley was awfully good about telling you that the top people in every party pretty well across the whole Western world, doesn't matter what the party was, top people are always a member of the same organization. They're vetted way in advance. And they play the game of left and right, etc. And then when you have their books, their members' books, which they published at one time when they had annual meetings, You see all the names at the back. Even the heads of communist parties for countries like in Britain were in attendance to their global meetings. And Ireland too, right? A lot of their members were there too. So, the top bankers that run these nations were also in attendance, say, for the future of the British Empire, funded by Rockefeller. And, of course, all the old Milner Group's guys were there. That taken over, and their descendants, because they hand them off to their offspring. And here we are down to the present day. Folks still can't catch, because it's never mentioned, so you can't catch on, you see. It's not mentioned very much at all. In fact, the history given by the BBC is such a, oh, well, Orwell said it, who controls the past, etc., and the future, and all the rest of it, has all been said before. And it's so true. It's so incredibly true. And then again, you have this wonderful, and it's wonderful from the elite's point of view. We are running the world through creating factions and divisions. Eh? And Britain's sunk, basically, with mass migration. So is Germany, to an extent, too. All from these wars in the Middle East and across Northern Africa for years and years. And they haven't finished yet. We know that there'll be even more, so that'll be the complete end of it, when more, again, military-age guys will rush through by the millions into Europe, when they do away with the last few countries left, like Syria. They won't give up with Syria and Iran, because it's not our wars. It's for another reason, as we all know. And, by the way, that is another reason as well, that a lot of folk are protesting and really upset and ticked off, because these endless wars... that people haven't fathomed. They can't fathom out why they're even going on. I mean, the wealth of America, I'm talking about the average citizen, has been squandered in 30 years of straight years of war. People forget that. It didn't start with 9/11. They already had Desert Storm in 1991, and then had the flyovers and all the military around Iraq for years. That was a fortune right there. And then they hit it again in 2003, using it as an excuse. Of course, 9/11 is an excuse, even though Saddam had nothing to do with it. It was all on the list of the PNAC group. We all know that stuff. It's all published. You can find it up there, yeah, I'm sure, on the net. So you're living through a big agenda. I mentioned it so many times. You're living through a script. It's a big business plan. Exactly is how a big business plan runs. In business plans, and that's a striking thing with United Nations and the communist organizations before the United Nations, they all have these five-year plans for one part and 10 years for another and 50-year plans for some, and even 100-year plans for other parts of it. That's how it's run. And that's how big multinational, international corporations run too. Huge agendas going way off into the future where maybe they'll hire and retire three times, three generations sometimes, you know. All planned that way. How do we make it happen? And then have their foundations, which are so important to all of this, the tax-free foundations that manage the world. You know, these are the ones who create and finance and train leaders for future warfare, including the NGOs and the ones who train the Antifa groups, etc. They're all from the big foundations owned by the richest folk on the planet. This is not conspiracy stuff. Read Foundations, Their Power and Influence, written years ago, all to do with the Norman Dodd's investigation into it and the Rees Committee, how they looked into the foundations in America back in the 50s and 60s. I wondered why they were funding the top foundation, like the Ford Carnegie and the Ford Foundation, but that time was already taken over by other foundations that are awfully well known. And that they were funding groups to destroy America and radically change it and so on. It made no sense to the people. So they sent a congressional committee out there to investigate it, and they were shocked by what they found. The head of the Ford Foundation at that time admitted. And you actually get old audios or videos of Norman Dodd talking about this. And he asked them why they were funding these groups. And the head of the Ford Foundation in America said that we're working hard to create a system, an alteration of cultures and education, so we can seamlessly blend that of the Soviet Union with America down the road. They could blend it all together. Yeah. Most folk haven't got a clue today about all that. It's just amazing, but it's all published. It's in their books, written by the guys who are involved in it. And that's what I'm often said too. You can stuff your head full of all the data you want, but it's not enough, obviously, to change the present, which is the way you change the future. You've got to understand more. It's more than just learning who did what. You got to find out why. You also have to look into all the whys, how people went along with things and why they went along with things and accepted conditions and systems that they shouldn't have. Again, too, how can you possibly even live under a system and accept at the same time that most of the agencies above you and government are secret and run secretively on plans and agendas you're not given even access to? You might down the road have laws implemented by them upon you, but you know you're not even brought into the debate about things, to setting up or anything. Now, who decides the future of a nation? Think about it. Do you get to fill out questionnaires about what you want to see in the future of a nation? Do you? For voting? You're just given the front people to vote for, aren't you? It doesn't matter what party is in, the same agenda goes ahead. Look at the free trade deals. Generations went by for free trade deals pretty well. And then the ones in the 90s to do with the North American free trade. First it was a free trade agreement, the North American free trade agreement. And then you had the three amigos, two prime ministers and a president, Mexico, Canada, the States, meeting every year to further tie us into a binding, that's what they called it, a binding system, bound together, which would be the nucleus of an EU-type authority, a European parliamentary authority down the road. That's what they hoped for. And then they would start bringing more Latin American countries in, and the Caribbean countries too, naturally. All discussed and printed and the rest of it. But it was done, it was admitted to, that the whole thing was drafted up and worked upon for years by the Council on Foreign Relations, a group that's a private group that often claims itself to be the establishment. One of his videos it put out itself talked about itself as the establishment. And you don't vote for them. Most folk don't even know what they are or that they exist. You're given these front comedians of politicians to look at and boo and throw tomatoes at, you know. And that's what you're given for politics. Have you ever heard any real wisdom come out of the mouths of politicians? Come on. Come on. You watch this Punch and Judy show. That's what it's called, Punch and Judy show. Like they used to have at fairs in the Middle Ages and all up to the 20th century. Where people would have these puppets bashing each other with clubs and so on. That's what politicians are. They're there to take the heat, but not to tell you what's really going on. The key to all of this, of course, is that think tanks, privately owned think tanks, have run the world for an awful long time. And they still do. As I say, the top politicians are picked long before the public even hear their names to vote for. And they're vetted, and they'll do what they're told, there's no doubt about it. And all parties are in on it at the top. That's why when nothing really changes for the better for the general population, it gets worse and worse. And I can remember looking at the old books I found about Canada as an example. And I've seen the same for Britain. But you have the Departments of Information and Statistics and owned by the government pretty well. And everyone's measured and weighed and yada yada and numbered long, long before we came along, our generation. And I've got ones going back to the early 1900s and right down to how many matchsticks were made by companies and things like that. Just incredible data they had in us all before they had computers. At least we're told it anyway. But anyway, it is quite fascinating to see how these massive books with the year's production and costs and all the rest of it and every little company in the country listed. But back in the early 20th century in Canada, Britain at that time, or London, they ran it all. I hate seeing Britain as like a strange entity. What the heck is Britain really? It's got millions of people, all kinds of people living in it. And before the mass migration, there were still lots of different kinds living in it. The Yorkshire folk had their own identity and culture. And it was, and different parts of the country was similar. Had been for centuries, that kind of thing. But when it comes to official purposes, you see, and taxation, things like that, then they want you to be one part of Britain or for war and send you off to fight for things you have no idea that it's really all about. You never get told the truth. And when you come back from these wars, the ordinary folk have either lost their jobs or work or their farms or whatever, and nothing's ever the same again. And then you've got another one. It's the same kind of thing over and over. And between that, you're global. I remember back in the 90s talking about this. I said, eventually, you know, well, because you kept talking about global this and global that and how it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And we'd all be happy under globalism and all the companies were putting this rah-rah thing, the governments were putting rah-rah and hands across the sea, etc. And they came out with their real plans, which was international free trade for the big top corporations. So they could really send their stuff all over the planet from all countries and have the citizens back home in the first world countries paying for all. Do you ever wonder why you can order things from China for peanuts, for cheaper than you could even post a letter in your own country to your neighbour? You're paying for it, that's why. That's called free trade. It's part of the deal. And it isn't just China you're paying for their postage to you. It's quite a few countries too. We can look up the lists of the nations, including some in the Middle East, by the way. You're paying the bulk of their postage on whatever's getting transferred around the world. Free trade. Great deal for the corporations, isn't it? And you pay for all. And at the same time, you end up with no work back home because your own governments, again, all kinds, right-wing and left-wing in succession, all signed on to integrate it further and further as they get in. And then you end up with no work back home, no factories, no ability to produce anything. You don't even have the ability to make your own basic painkillers or acetaminophen, a very simple medication, because even that's farmed out to other countries. First it was farmed out to China under free trade, that's why it was so cheap for a long time, and then at length last year, the year before, they gave the contract under the new Trans-Pacific Partnership, which they included India in for some reason, and then it moved their base of operations to India, and it's way more expensive now. But in, at home, oh, nothing's made here, eh? There you go. And you can't even make anything to save yourself if you need. This is the thing. I keep thinking back to Britain in World War One and then Two. And Britain was locked down in World War One because of the Germany then, and Britain as well, had submarines. And submarines could play havoc with shipping that was bringing in food and supplies and all. But especially in World War Two, there's far more subs around. And Britain had already given up its ability to be self-sustaining by farming. I've always thought that's an odd thing. That I mean, food is one of the most basic things you need. Without it, everything else is a pipe dream. Just everything starts with food, folks. Food and water. And why would your nations literally make you helpless? Well, once again, it was the big corporations that dealt with the shipping lines. We've had leaders in Canada whose parents were involved in this too, that their own shipping line companies for transferring food to other countries, etc. And often when they're combined with interest in agriculture, like agri-food businesses, they decide what countries are going to get the cheap food and who's not going to eat, and even try to, and even lobby at home to put laws to stop you even making enough food at home for yourself. This is all rigged, you see. There's no such thing as a free enterprise system. It's just the opposite. And it's not new. Say, Britain almost sunk in World War II because it couldn't produce the food for itself. It was completely, almost completely dependent for a long time on food coming in from the US. And a lot of that ship eventually was in trouble after 1942 as well. And they had all, you can actually look up the old videos on wartime farms, for instance. And you see what they had to do, go through, and the government just expands. Oh, they love it during war, they expand socialistic systems and principles, and government departments just blossom and swell like cancers, like you wouldn't believe. And that's why they love socialism, because anything you do, you're told, because it's all for the good of all. You're all in it together, etc. And you all pull along together and do what you're told for the good of everybody else, for the greater good. Never changes, eh? And during World War II, the government in Britain stole farms all over the place off of people. Because here's the tragedy of things. Great Britain, eh? Let's be proud of Great Britain, eh? There had been so many wars all through the 1800s. The country, the people were broke with taxes. And really, even then, they're kept in a starvation level, most of the people. Not the middle class and upper class, of course. But they were. They went through the Industrial Revolution in the 1700s and 1800s. So bad it was that even Benjamin Franklin, this is the truth here, in his own memoirs, talked about that when he visited Britain. And he saw these factory workers coming out of a big shoe factory and boot factory, barefoot in the winter, because they couldn't afford to buy the boots themselves. This was reality, folks, you know. There was no welfare system. Folk had to work often 16 hours a day just to eat and get a place over their head, which was a hovel. Often there was 10, 12 or more to a room. It was a horror show. But again, the wonders of propaganda and so on can displace all that and really tuck it away into the background until it's a hazy thing, then it's forgotten altogether. That's how it works. And then you end up in the 20th century, and they're already just had the Boer War, you know, getting waylaid. So we're taking over Africa and South Africa and so on. Again, by the Milner Group, Lord Alfred Milner, for the Royal Institute for International Affairs, that private group that was just called the Milner Group in the kindergarten at the time. And they picked youngsters up in university in Oxford, All Souls, and they trained them. They trained them to be governors of different countries that they would take over. And they list all their names, of course, if you go into their histories, long, long histories. But anyway, that's how it was done. And the people end up in these wars, world wars. They needed, by the way, the Milner Group wanted world wars. They mentioned that. Because then they could then further amalgamate countries, even competing and conflicting in wartime, warring countries, together at the end of it, when everybody's on their knees. That's how you got the League of Nations idea coming in, you see. So it's, the past is a horror show. So anyway, World War II comes along, and Britain had lost so many farmers. And like, you talk about dads and sons often, and uncles, all wiped out in some areas, a lot of them. They would join local regiments, boom, gone, same in Canada and elsewhere in Australia, gone, New Zealand. And so it left a lot of them just struggling with farms between, in the 20 years between, you know, from the end of World War One and the beginnings of World War Two, 1939. And so the government, if you couldn't, they ordered you to produce. And if you couldn't produce enough because you didn't have enough manpower or people running the farm or whatever, or maybe it was an old dad left, all the sons were dead from the previous war, the government just grabbed them and stole them. And then they amalgamated a whole bunch of them, you see, here, there, and everywhere, and they would give it to these rich characters who still own them today, by the way, you know. And then of course, they've got volunteers and land army. It's even better, isn't it? It smacks the same kind of... you get little smackings or smatterings of the same system down to the present time. Because then you had land army volunteers and all these folk coming in for the war effort who were free labour for you. And every square inch of workable land had to be ploughed and the whole thing and used for the war effort. We're all in it together once more, you see. And you could get vegetables, but you couldn't get much meat at all for the general population. Winston Churchill hadn't a problem. They had parties for Winston. He'd talk about it. His secretary talked about it. If you ever bother reading the books on it, his personal secretary wrote about it and how they had these huge parties in certain parts of London, underground bunkers, huge, like palaces, really. In fact, some of them were under palaces and other ones were outside London. And they had everything they could imagine of eating and food and elegant wines, etc., champagne, the whole lot, all through the war. But they're ordinary people. Being good people, mind you, put up with it and the rationing, starvation level rationing, until there was no obese people before World War II, pretty well, in Britain, because they'd been through a Great Depression in between two world wars, and in both wars they had rationing. It's just astonishing what you put up with. And the folk who go off and fight have no idea. They wouldn't even know who Lord Alfred Milner was. You may get his name in a newspaper once in a while as one of his proteges was sent over to govern South Africa or something like that, you know, or India. But they have no idea of this even Winston Churchill. Had an argument, it's recorded in Parliament in Britain. Because at the beginnings of the war, he had no idea that these characters have been manipulating the system to get Britain. He was also getting manipulated by another group to get into the war, by the way, an outside group. But the same token, he was ticked off when he found out that this other group that had other plans for the Great War, this World War II, you know, and his mission and what they'd wanted to accomplish, and he argued about it. Because at that time, it was a very secretive group, you know. Different names it had at the time. The All Souls group was one of them as well. It was so secretive, like layers of it, that in an inner party and an outer party, you know? Just like the CFR still has today for their missions abroad, so to speak. Yeah, the folk in Britain fought those wars, all truly believing they were doing the best of all to save everybody and doing it, you know. Hadn't a clue what was to come at the end of it. Hadn't a clue that Winston Churchill, and I put up the articles years ago. You should go into cuttingthroughthematrix.com and look at some of them. Lots of the authors use my material. So stacks of it there. But Winston Churchill literally talks about all of this too, as I say. And his desire, he said, this is wonderful. When the war broke, he says, we shall probably, and hopefully, he says, establish our long dream of united Europe. I mean, meanwhile, he's telling folk on the radio at nights, you go off and fight and die to save your culture, your way of life. Meanwhile, he's talking, and the sector recorded all these things, eh? Our united Europe. Oh, no, old idea. And now, if you'd told that to the British folk at that time, they'd been completely bewildered. What was he talking about, united Europe? We're fighting to keep our own way of life. We're quite happy with it the way it is, you know. It's never perfect, and it's pretty bad for a lot of people, but it's better than a lot of folk had even in Europe at that time. And every culture likes its own culture to an extent, don't you? Because it's familiar to you, if nothing else. But it's also part of it. And I mean, it's across the world. You meet people who will fight and die for their nations or the plot of land that they live on. It's a natural thing. You feel tied to the land. It's in the soil. It's in the genes almost. And you have that bonding to it. I remember reading a poem by a Scots guy that wrote about the 1930s and 40s, maybe into the 50s. A miner, and he talked about having to leave because Scotland, like parts of England too, and Wales, because of this corrupt system that always ran you, was often it couldn't afford to. As he said in his poem, a country like Scotland, it couldn't afford to feed his children, you know, so he had to move. But meanwhile, you had the richest folk concentrated in London. The richest folk in the world at that time concentrated in parts of London, especially the city of London. And of course, the migration helped, you see, to expand the empire. So we're all used and abused, and most folk haven't got a clue it's even happening at the time. Instead, they're given what they've got in the States at the moment. They've got the front groups. The BLM groups, with the heads of them. It's no mystery, it's not conspiracy theory. They admit, and they're out there admitting, there's even a video of them admitting that they're trained Marxist organisers who know exactly what they're doing, where Marxism always has front groups and gets them all battling with other groups. And then you have the Antifa groups. There's no mystery there. There's quite a good history of them, long history. And then the reorganization of them back again in the 90s, because they used them. They used to send them in to the anti-global meetings that were going on. The anti-globalist meetings were awfully good at the time, and folk came across from the countries to protest these meetings, where they were, again, planning offshore all your work and your factories off to China and the Far East. But in would come the Antifa group and jump in on the bandwagon and start throwing their usual Molotov cocktails at police cars, etc., and give everybody else a bad name, you see. And they actually say it in their handbooks, you see, that they piggyback upon certain events that cause that are plausible and are emotional events, jump on top of them, end up being the champions, but then sear it off into your revolution. This is how they do it, you see. Well-funded, too. But once folks' emotions get up, they seldom think very clearly. It's very interesting to watch the phenomenon. I've mentioned it before, that the terrible things that happened in Rwanda, with the genocide in Rwanda, you had the eventual complete unleashing of many years of utter hatred against this other tribe, that had skirmishes with over 100 or 200 years even, and the hatred had boiled up, and it was really institutional, and they let loose, and literally the chopping up of people went on for weeks. You can actually hear it on the audios from people who were there at the time with cameras, you know, from reporters from abroad. You could actually hear it. It was terrible, and that's what happens when clever folk can utilise the hatred and stir it up and actually augment it, really thicken it, you might say, intensify, and then they use it for different purposes. Big coffee plantation growers were involved in this too, outside the country, because there's always other reasons for what you see in the news, always. And always other interests behind anything to do with skirmishes or wars. There's always economic interests lying deep, deep below on behalf of those who understand resources and how to use them and who want them. Rwanda, reporters were on the roads. It's like, it actually, I always think of these, whenever you see roads full of people, you think, remember, of refugees as one. Like, I always think of refugees in carts in Europe and so on, the beginning of, or even during World War One and then World War Two. But then you get other refugees that really are promoted to come into countries now. These are like the massive invasion across Europe. That was all. That took billions of dollars to work all that out and to finance and even train them. Some of them coming in were telling you they'd all been trained in advance for purposes of taking down European countries. And we know some of the folk who were behind it because they even put videos out themselves about it in some of these countries. Unashamedly, yeah. And then down the road, you use them, eh? To take down the nations. Just standard warfare technique. Migration has always been used for this kind of purpose. Migration was used in ancient times. You have biblical episodes of it, and pre-biblical too. Because not everything happens in the Bible, obviously. But you had different groups that would remove people of where they lived and transfer them to other nations in order to destabilize their power and dethrone them from their over their own people so that the people could be used by the conquering people coming in, you see. So there's different ways you can use migration, mass migration by law. The Soviet era was awfully interesting, I always think, because the Soviet era used very, very old techniques, very, very old techniques. You get wisps of it through your lifetime. This is why it's important to try always remember as much as you can per day as you're living through things, you know? Because real history is inside you. You live it. Forget the books that are written later that'll change it all. And so you're living in history. And you must use your own perception. Don't be given it by someone else, you know? Anything that they're offered, investigate it completely to make up your own mind. But the Soviet system is just like the Norman system. Sent troops in, of course, to different countries like Latvia. You had Latvia. You've got articles coming out, you know, years later in Latvia after the so-called Soviet system collapsed, which it didn't really collapse as such, you know, not the way it's presented. But yeah, you had Latvia and you had Ukraine. You had different countries where the Soviets had tremendous influence in the Soviet Pact countries. And they had troops into many of these countries, training them and so on. And it stayed them with full-time barracks, much the same as the US does today across the Middle East and even Beirut at one time and so on. But the Soviets were given extra money if they would marry local women. The idea to breed themselves in to society, which would help dilute the cultural homogeneity of the people. It's much harder down the road, 20 years or 30 years down the road, for the entire people to stand up and throw you out. When by that time, at least one third of them are part Russian, you see. It's all through so many folks' families by that time. That's how it was done. And that was a deliberate policy. They paid the troops extra if they would settle in the areas by marrying girls in those areas where they were stationed. Very old system, a very old technique. And it smacks, as I say, the same kind of thing that happened with the Norman invasion into England or Britain, or England really. And even the Romans did try this too one time. And after the Romans really collapsed, or the same kind of thing, and went back home to Rome from England, they did leave a lot of people back in England at the time. And we have histories of them from monks. It was really interesting, of certain families that still stayed behind, and they're very old Roman families. But again, the Normans, when they came into Britain, they had Prima Nocta, which is first night, of course. And of course, the nobility would literally, if a maiden was going to get married in the local areas, with the Saxon areas and so on, in England, they'd just take the right to have sex with them in the hope they'd get pregnant. So now you've got relatives within the local community that you'll groom to be in charge of the community. An old technique, really. Nothing new about it. I'm sure it might still go on in some parts of the world today. It wasn't just first night and the whole thing. The idea was to breed themselves into the people. And even their offspring would become future leaders over those peoples. In Ireland, you have an interesting situation where some of the Fitz, like Fitzsimmons and so on, often had noble parentage, but they were illegitimate, but they were still given a legal standing, you see. And so hence the prefix Fitz part to their names, Fitzgerald, etc. And so that still stood today. But this isn't getting off the topic. Really, what it is showing you is that great powers manage us all. And it doesn't come from little people in every generation just reinventing the wheel. These are sciences that are recorded and understood over many, many, many centuries. Going way back to Plato and even before Plato's, some of these philosophers in ancient Greece were awfully interesting because they were interested in what was happening around them. And they liked to put it down, especially in their schools. And the leisure class came to them, you know, and they were getting trained into this. And philosophy wasn't just there for passing the time, although the school came from the term, really, leisure, you know. And wealth and leisure, you had leisure, because the ordinary people hadn't time to learn anything except maybe a trade or something. But those who ruled, the ruling classes, or maybe even castes for all that, in Greece, and Greece is a huge area, it wasn't just a little, there's so many hundreds of islands, in fact, involved too. But some of them, again, were actually condemned by the state, some of these teachers, because they wanted to overthrow the system and bring in this new system. And Socrates, of course, wasn't just get offered his poison because of that. There were definite charges laid against them. It's interesting, the Enlightenment era, they always resurrect Socrates and his teachings. Interesting teachings, absolutely. And a good mind behind it, and maybe a better mind behind the translators, because you can fudge an awful lot of perhaps better thinking it by translating it in a certain way. But anyway, you find that Socrates was also charged with literally trying to subvert the youth. It wasn't sexually, at least that wasn't promoted as such or part of the charge. It was to train the youth to overthrow the parents and a system, so to be revolutionaries. That's what it was about. And that, when it was brought out into the open, the parents and the nobility just lost it. They said, what, had no idea. And this all came out during the inquiries. It was so bad that many of the students had to flee for their lives because they were trained to be revolutionaries. Plato had to disappear for a while. And he did, quite a long time. And they had this interesting similarity to different groups that even, like the Essenes that came along too, in the Middle East as well. They had lots of things in common, where you would get groups in. You would have an initial meeting groups, like an open day, put that way, every so often, where folk could come in and listen to the lower exoteric teachings. And they would say, that's rather pleasant, etc. I wouldn't mind joining that. And then if one of the youngsters came in to join it, and probably paid by the parents who thought it would give them a good education, then if they had the right stuff, because they had levels and degrees, just like later groups had too, of induction, all the way up, as I say, to the Lord Alfred Milner group that has an inner party and an outer party. That's where the idea came from, George Orwell's 1984. The inner party and the outer party. in a circle of friends, etc., and it comes from foreign relations. So very old ideas. And all elitists, you see, going way back to even Socrates, it's all to do with elitism. And through the various dialogues that they would have in their teachings, they'd always have a discourse, a kind of fantasy discourse with someone else as a teaching tool. If I said to you, blah, 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 what would you reply or think? And then you try to guide them into what you the way you want them to think. But it's always to question what is. What is this and what is that? And not really to enlighten you as such, maybe partly, but then to take you off and reshape you and to now think about it this way, you know? Well, that's how people are recruited today for the most horrible things on humanity. Oh, what do you think all these little people? It's kind of like The Third Man, the movie. Awfully, one of the best movies ever made, The Third Man. It was so well directed and written and directed and filmed. Old black and white movie. And the location was fantastic during actual reoccupation of a country that was post-World War II, where you'd still had, and you'd still had the Russian and British and American and French quadrants, and these big cities were by the Allies, as they say, and all these displaced peoples. None of them wanted to be grabbed if they had a background or come from a country that was now owned, run over, or ruled by the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union could take you back, just demand that you, even though you weren't in their country, you were in Vienna and so on. They could demand that you go back there, you see. Horrible things happened. But in the movie, the villain, Orson Welles, is up in, he's meeting his pal. His pal came over to see him, and his pal thought that Orson, you know, the third man, was dead because he had a fake burial. And then he found he was alive, and he came up to question him. And Orson Welles had been really been sought. For, the reason he pretended at death was he was sought by the police and the Allied forces at the time, the military police, because one of his scams was getting penicillin and diluting it and then reselling it for big money. And it was so, and went to children's hospitals, and they were dying of meningitis and things. And of course, the antibiotic was no use. It was too diluted. All these kind of, these scams did go on, by the way. Scams and medicine have always ripped the present time, as you all know, I'm sure. And so Orson Welles meets the guy on a carousel, a big, one of these big round wheels goes up around and so on. And they go up in it. And at the top, Welles talks to his friend that came over to see him. He said, look at all these people down there. Because his friend was saying, well, you've been accused of this. Is this true? You know, your medicine is now killing children. And Orson Welles looks down and says, look at all those people down there. And he says, do you really think that this system thinks any more of those people? You know, he says, the state calls them the proletariat. You know, I call them the masses and so on. And the communists call them the masses, and I call them the, you know. In other words, they're just little dots, he says. How much is each dot really worth to you? And that's how a psychopath would describe humanity, the victims of whatever. They're just, you know, they're nothings. And that's how we're really ruled, folks. You have no idea of how many layers of psychopaths are churned out of academia and selected for their qualities as psychopaths, the particular traits, to do dastardly things over the general populations. They're generally arrogant, well-paid, trained in either psychology or behaviorism, often both, and persuasive techniques so folk can be convinced to obey them, right down to even giving up your own life, you know. Are you really worth the money your government will spend on you? Why don't you just sign this little thing and decide, yeah, I've had enough. I've become a burden on, and you end up with eugenical euthanasia. Mm-hmm.
Saskatoon I came, my place and habitation, and no man leave with shame, for my place and habitation, and no man gan a war, for frail a bonny hills and dales, or Caledonia. It was early in the morning, just by the break of day, we were awakened by the turnkey, who unto us did say, "Arise, ye hapless convicts, arise, ye in and all, this is the day ye are to stray, the Caledonia." We all arose, put on our clothes, our hearts were full of grief. Our friends who stood around the coach could grant us no relief. Our parents, wives, and sweethearts, their hearts were broken twa, to see us leave the hills and dales of Caledonia. Farewell, my aged mother, I'm vexed for what I've done. I hope none will cast up to you the race that I have run. I hope God will protect you when I am far away, far frail the bonny hills and dales of Caledonia. Best of men, and likewise my own sweetheart, it's Catherine is her name. Nae mair we'll walk by Clyde's clear stream, or by the broomy law, for I must leave the hills and dales of Caledonia. Leave the hills and dales of Caledonia.